There was a lot of things like that where you'd think, what the f***?
From Stuff, a new 12-part documentary podcast.
He was into sex every day.
The commune. Sex, drugs, and a guru called Bert. There are crimes, but this isn't a whodunit, it's a whydunit.
Good God, adults agreed to this?
The commune. Find it now on your favourite podcast platform or at stuff.co.nz/the commune.
You've already been welcomed to Centrepoint.
Four hours ago, I found out the person that I've been dating for the last 6 months is a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks' lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series.
And that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris. And this is my story, Conning the Con.
Hello listeners, and welcome to this extra special bonus episode of myself speaking with Elgin Strait of the Falling Out podcast live at CrimeCon London, June 2022. I feel especially honoured that Elgin agreed to collaborate with me on this live session to discuss his activism work and to speak about the Unification Church and his experiences being born into this movement as a second generation member. For anyone looking to learn more about the Unification Church, I strongly recommend Elgin's work, and I'll post a link to his website in the episode description. And if you would like to join me at one of these live talks, you can visit crimecon.co.uk to get 10% off of your tickets for Glasgow September 10th, where we will all be getting back together for another day of true crime talks with podcasters, journalists, documentary teams, private investigators, authors, and much more. Just use the code CULT at the checkout today or follow the link in the episode description. Thank you, Elgin, for this opportunity. Thank you, CrimeCon, for representing smaller podcasts. And thank you to the guests who came to watch, with a whole host of people being turned away at the door. Here is Elgin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this live session, and thank you all for joining me here today to talk about cults, coercion, and corruption. My name is Casey, and I am the host of the Cult Vault podcast, which is a long-format, primarily interview-based podcast that focuses on the true stories of individuals who are survivors that have experienced cults, high-demand groups, and more. When the show started, just over 2 years ago, it was a researched and single-hosted scripted show with me looking at a different infamous cult each week. And all I really knew of cults at that time was what I had consumed from true crime documentaries and other podcasts. And around episode 4 of the show, I was approached by an author who asked if I would be interested in reading her memoir about her experience in a place called Zendik Farm. I don't know if anyone's heard of Zendik. Really interesting commune, so I recommend anybody interested in the subject to go and read up about that. Helen Zuman had penned this memoir called Mating in Captivity about her time in a group that had a radical take on sex and relationships. And after I read this memoir, I realised that there was just so much more to this subject than I'd ever really considered. And I asked Helen if she would be willing to come on the show and chat with me, and she said yes. And so Helen was the first guest on my show. And after that, the trajectory of the podcast just changed completely. I have really had the privilege of being able to interview almost 200 survivors of cults and high demand groups at this point. And many of you may not realise that the tactics that are involved in cults and coercion are in operation in everyday situations. And some of you may have experienced some of these tactics personally. One-on-one cults exist in domestic abusive relationships and also exist in environments that you can hear about at other panels across the weekend, things that include, you know, street gangs, and there's ex-offenders and people who have been through the prison system as well, which in itself has those types of methodologies in place. So although cults may seem like things that exist far away from us and that we as people could never be encouraged into a cult or a high demand group, I want to share with you all today why that simply isn't true. And to help me with this, I have an amazing guest, someone who was born into a movement with no choice on his participation, someone who has made it his mission to highlight the coercion, abuse and corruption of this particular group, someone who has his own compelling platform and uses his voice for change whilst giving others the chance to tell their story too. So please welcome my special guest of the Falling Out podcast, Elgin Strait. So, Elgin, would you like to start by introducing yourself to the listeners?
Sure. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here. I'm amazed to see the turnout. It's quite encouraging. So, as Casey mentioned, my name is Elgin Strait. I was born into a cult called the Unification Church. It's more commonly known as the Moonies. That's sort of the pop culture terminology for it. I left that cult mentally when I was around 18 years old, but due to the immense pressure that the cult placed upon us to marry other people from the cult, I accepted an arranged marriage to someone within the cult. That marriage lasted for about 15 years, and when it was all over, I sort of felt like for the first time I could like look back at my life for the first time with no attachments to the cult. So I almost feel like I left twice. And at that moment, that's when I really tried to understand what happened to me and what happened to my family. I read a lot of books, I took a lot of courses, and it became quite clear to me that one very common trait amongst most cults is that they employ a lot of guilt and shame. They use that tactic against their members, and that creates an air of secrecy within the cult. And it occurred to me that throughout my life, it would have been of immense value to me if I had just heard the stories of other people who had left the cult. And so I decided to try to document that on my own show, Falling Out. So my show, Falling Out, is me effectively interviewing other people who grew up in the same cult. Talking about their experiences within it, exposing the abuses within it, and talking them through their journey of leaving it and how they are rebuilding their life afterwards. I'm very pleased to say that I've lost count of the number of people who have left the cult as a direct result of listening to the show. Sorry, it's quite emotional for me to say that, but that is the reality. I feel extremely privileged to have been able to help people do that. That's that.
Thank you, Elgin. And I mean, it's not easy to ask you to give us a summary or a brief history of the Unification Church, but for anybody that isn't too familiar with the movement, is there a quick kind of roundup that you can give us?
It's going to have to be a very short version. Okay, it's called the Moonies because it was started by a guy named Sun Myung Moon. To place this in space-time, Moon was born in what is now North Korea in 1920. At the age of 16, he claims he had a revelation from God telling him that it was his job to carry on the unfulfilled mission of Jesus. So that's one of the core tenets of the faith, is that Jesus failed in his mission and a second coming was required. Moon claimed that he was the second coming. Obviously, they always claim it's them when they have these revelations. It's never anyone else. And to create this sort of new Garden of Eden on Earth, humanity had to be so-called grafted onto a pure blood lineage that Moon could create through a variety of methods that I won't get into now just because we don't have enough time. Moon in the late 50s into the early 60s he was basically running a sex cult in Korea at the time. And he went to jail a few times for doing that, although that's not the story that the cult tells you. And eventually, I think his sordid past running that sex cult in Korea, combined with his sense for the market opportunity for extremism in the U.S., led him to flee his past in Korea and move to the U.S. in the 60s. At that point, the cult started aggressively recruiting cult members in the U.S., including my parents, and we'll talk about the coercion methodology later. But to call it a religion is actually, I think, a complete misdirection, and it's intentional, because what the Moonies really is it's an enormous, enormous constellation of front groups. I cannot over-exaggerate the enormity of this spider web. I saw a list created in 1980, and it had 1,400 front groups listed on it. Those were just the ones that were known then, and that was 40 years ago. And all of those front groups serve to bring money and power back to Moon and back to his family. And to give you a couple examples there, the Moon started the newspaper, the Washington Times. He owns it, or his family owns it. And that is a font of right-wing misinformation and disinformation. That's a whole other story. But Moon has basically grafted himself onto the right wing in America and served as a useful mouthpiece for them in a variety of different ways. There's a lot of influence there. Did anyone eat sushi today or in the last few days? No. Any hands? Okay. There's a 90% chance that sushi came from a Moonie-run business. The Moonies own a few companies that supply 90% of the sushi to the U.S. and Europe. I'm guilty as well of eating sushi, even though I know this. They own a gun company in America. So it serves to bring money and power back to Moon. And it's worth saying that all of that was built on the backs of our parents, who were basically coerced into working for Moon for free, effectively, or at reduced rates, working for one of these front organizations. My parents worked for the Washington Times for pretty much their entire careers. Sorry, let me pause there. Last thing to say is, Moon died in 2012, but the cult lives on in a variety of his family members. So it's sort of splintered into this like Game of Thrones situations where they're all trying to like fight for the remains of the empire across a few different factions, including a couple of his sons, one of his daughters, his widow. They're all fighting for it, and it's a complete disaster. But it bizarrely, it actually makes a good environment for me to be speaking out, because they're too busy fighting each other to really care about what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. And if I make one of them look bad, the other ones are like, "Yeah, don't they look like shit?" And I'm okay, yeah. If that's how you want to roll, fine. So anyway, sorry.
And one of the reasons that Moon was able to make this religious movement so big, with thousands of followers worldwide, was through a set of methodologies that were kind of carefully honed over a number of years. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we discussed on our Zoom call last week was the initial introduction of the first generation into the church. Yeah. So we kind of started at love bombing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the kind of first generation process of somebody being brought into one of these groups.
Yeah.
So I wondered if you could just talk us through that process.
Absolutely. Can I just ask again, show of hands, love bombing, anyone familiar with the term? Okay. Nearly everyone. That term was coined by the Moonies. They created it in the 60s and the 70s. And now it's most commonly known, the most common context that you all are probably familiar with it is in the context of dating and trying to win someone over. But the Moonies started it. They invented it, and it was specifically to coerce people to become full-time members. And the way it worked back then, and it's still happening today, is It usually starts with someone from the opposite sex approaching you on the street or in some sort of public setting, and that's intentional. Having it be someone from the opposite sex injects a little bit of sexual chemistry and sexual energy and attraction into that very first interaction that you have with someone. So an attractive person walks up to you and says, "Hey, we're hosting this dinner. Are you interested in world peace? Are you interested in making the world a better place? Okay, if you are, you should come to this cultural event that we're hosting at our house." Sounds very innocuous. No one mentions anything about the cult. And it's almost intentionally something that it would be impossible to disagree with. Do you want to end hunger? Yeah, okay, of course. No one's gonna disagree with this. So inevitably some people end up coming to an event, and it's like a potluck dinner or something like that, some like a barbecue type of thing. But when you're there, you don't know it, but you're the mark. You're the target when you get there. You are the target for love bombing. Everyone there knows who's a member and who's not a member. If you're not a member, you walk into the room, and everyone showers you with attention. You walk in, and it might be kind of subtle, but all of a sudden you're the most interesting person in the room. Everyone cares about what you say. Everyone's interested. They'll laugh at your jokes, and they'll make you feel loved. You get the sort of love and affection that a rock star or a celebrity would get. It's not normal to feel that, but it creates a little dopamine hit. And when you leave, you miss it. You want that dopamine hit back. So then when they say, "Hey, actually, we're doing a longer event. It's actually like a weekend away. We're doing this retreat. Would you like to come?" You might say, "Okay," and you go there. The love bombing continues. Once you're isolated, though, they have more control. They can control what you eat. They can control when you sleep. They can control nearly all aspects of your life. And at that point, they start to whittle down your defenses whilst maintaining the love bombing pressure. And over time, in that environment, when your defenses are low, they also intentionally isolate you from the people that you love and the people that know about you and care about you. And they make it increasingly difficult for you to go and talk to them, even just to call them on the phone. They do this little by little. But over time, they're wearing you down. And eventually, it might be like, go to barbecue one night, then they invite you somewhere for the weekend, then they invite you somewhere for 7 days, then maybe it's 2 weeks. At the end of those 2 weeks, finally, they mention, "Oh, by the way, this is about Moon, and he's the Messiah, and would you like to join?" But by that point, it's been this long and gradual process. Not even that long, but it's been intentionally gradual. No one's upfront about what's happening to begin with. So that's one example of one of the coercion tactics.
And something I've found quite familiar across a lot of the interviews I've done is that after that love bombing comes a lot of the toxic positivity. Mm-hmm. So maybe messages of, maybe you should come to as many activities as Sally's coming to because she's committing this much time to the church. And wouldn't it be great if you. So it's kind of starting to add that element we're going to be nice to you if you give us more.
Yeah, yeah. They start demanding from you. And if you start adding any negativity or questioning, they use that against you. They say it's because you're not strong enough. You're too weak. In the case of the Moonies, they might tell you that it's Satan invading you. The spirit world is affecting you if you have any sort of negativity or questioning.
So if that's how the first generation of the Unification Church members were introduced to the church, why is it after the love bombing and the toxic positivity that people stay, that they don't leave, which leads to, of course, the second generation and survivors such as yourself?
Yeah. A lot of it has to do with the fact that it's an all-encompassing lifestyle. By that point, when I was to give you a sense, when I was growing up, my parents worked for a Moonie business, so all of their coworkers were Moonies. I went to a mo- I went, sorry, I went to church on Sundays. I saw Moonies there. Sometimes we had like sleepaway camps on the weekends. I saw Moonies there. So they take all of your the support network that someone would normally have. It all becomes part of that. It all becomes subsumed by the cult, so you don't have anything left. So then if you want to leave that environment, where do you go? You don't have any friends. You probably lost contact with your family. You probably burned that bridge. Where do you go? They make it almost impossible to leave because they intentionally burn all those bridges for you.
Would you say that the messages of guilt would come in at that point? Is there ever a time where the church might say, we've done all of this for you, and now, you know, if you leave after everything we've done, and are you threatened with consequences, like what will happen to your soul if you leave and your community and your family?
To give you some context there, we were so we haven't talked too much about the ideology, but sexual so-called purity is a big issue. And I was, as a so-called second generation, I, in theory, have a pure blood lineage that no one else in this room would have. And as a result, if I were to have sex with someone beyond the person that the cult said I could have sex with, then I would go to a worse place in hell than Hitler. The absolute worst place. There are all kinds of, like, they really embellish the stories, like, the fish in the spirit world will spit at you and like people, just really horrible stuff. Anyway, in theory, that's where I'm going now. I'll believe it when I see it.
So after this systematic recruitment and retainment of the first generation members, the mass weddings happen, the second generation are born.
Yeah.
What is that like for at the period of time where you were born into the movement? How soon is it that the babies are subjected to the same methodologies that the parents have been subjected to?
It's a good question. It's from birth, effectively. So we were at 8 days old. There are photos of pretty much all of us Mooney kids. 8 days old, we were put. We had to wear this kind of like white silk robe, and our parents would wear white silk robes. And they placed us in front of a photo of Moon and his wife and some of their family members. Our parents said a very solemn prayer, effectively pledging our lives to Moon for the rest of our lives. From 8 days old, our lives were given to them, effectively. And that indoctrination continued as far as I can remember. So we, every Sunday we had to wake up at 5 a.m. This is part of, like, a lot of cults use this tactic of basically, excuse my French, but fucking with your sleeping, to put you in a different state of mind. So every week for as long as I can remember, I'd wake up at 4:45 a.m. Lights would go on. My dad would come up. We'd have to put on our suits, and then go downstairs, stand in front of a photo of Moon and his wife, do three full bows to them, and then repledge our lives to them, pledging our blood, sweat, and tears to help them build the so-called kingdom of heaven on earth. That was every week. We went to multiple sort of indoctrination camps throughout the summers, spring breaks, all that sort of stuff. I personally went to an indoctrination program in Korea at the age of 13. I lived there for a year away from my family. There were about 100 kids, just for a bit of context, about 100 kids and four grown-ups looking after them. It was like Lord of the Flies. It was awful.
And that's in the family home. And then another really notable thing about the Unification Church is the weaponizing families against one another by the separation that occurs between parents and children. So where parents would be encouraged to go and leave the children for missionary work to raise money for the Unification Church, the children would be left.
Yeah, this is one of the most heartbreaking aspects of this, and we talk about this a lot on my show. The church would basically to facilitate parents working for Moon or one of his front groups full time. The church coerced parents into giving their kids up and putting them in orphanages, effectively. At the age of 100 days, they're put into these group care facilities where, yeah, you'd have, you know, toddlers up to like 6-7 years old, all living together. And there are many of these facilities around the world. There's a lot of these facilities around the world. I don't know how many of them are still in existence today. But yeah, kids were orphaned there, abandoned, so their parents could go work for this psychopath.
And there would be parents of other children who had been left that would be called to these houses to parent other children that were not their children.
Yeah.
So it was very, very systematically done in order to keep those families separated.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And once you're older and you're able to start raising money for the Unification Church, what would that look like in terms of your contribution? What are some of the things that you might see members of the church being involved in?
Yeah, so there's a lot of financial control completely. So first of all, if you're working for a church business, you're not getting paid market rate. They're underpaying you as massively as they can. Second of all, you're required to give away 10% of your pre-tax income to give that to the church, and that's just the baseline. But then every month it's like, oh, we need a donation for this thing that we're building, or we need a donation for this tour that we're running. Give us another $1,000. So there's a ton of financial coercion and pressure that's applied. But that doesn't even tie into what the real question that you're asking, which is for people that aren't doing that, they have these fundraising teams, and these were both adults and kids did this. You have a van of maybe, I don't know, seven or eight people driving around the country, in the U.S., driving around the country or driving around Europe. It happens here as well. Living in this van and selling trinkets on the side of the road or selling flowers in bars. It's called a mobile fundraising team, but people do this 6-7 days a week, 12-hour days. They sleep in the van, they eat fast food. People have died doing this. It's not without consequence, and no one has paid any price for this, and we talk about this on my show. In I think it was either 2001 or 2002, an 18-year-old girl was on one of these fundraising runs. She entered a guy's house and she was raped and murdered. No one has ever suffered any consequence for this. And this all ties into the coercion and the pressure, because we were taught as kids that the pathway to heaven was determined by the number of dollars that we put into the organization. That's the type of coercion that we're talking about. And I know it sounds crazy, and it is crazy, but that's the environment that I grew up in. You know, whatever people accept what you're born into. That was the reality for me and for many other people.
And I think it's really important to highlight that as well for people who often ask, you know, how or why would somebody join a cult? By birth, obviously, absolutely no choice in your part there. But even with your parents, the systematic approaches that are used are anybody can be a victim of this type of exploitation. And I think it's really important to point that out. And something else that you said that was interesting in our chat last week was about how it's impossible to change the belief systems of an individual if they're not willing to think past just accepting Moon and his words as gospel. So you said that if you were to question with somebody, they would say, you just have to take Moon's word for it, you just have to get on board. Mm-hmm. And we see that a lot at the moment with other groups popping up in America that are not related to the Unification Church directly.
Yeah.
You mentioned QAnon.
Yeah, QAnon's I see a lot of similarities between QAnon and the Unification Church. But I think, I guess, just to really like dig into that, like, and to make it relatable as almost like a warning sign of like, if you're ever thinking like, am I in a cult? Then like one of the main things to ask is like, how receptive is the group that you're in to just looking at the evidence and just trying to accept it at face value. because that is a big part of the indoctrination is like, and it's actually, and I think QAnon probably does this as well, although I'm not an expert, but basically it's like, if you, evidence of people speaking against the group is taken as, proof that they're right, because why would people be criticizing something unless it was doing something good? So they twist it around, and so if you ever find yourself in a place where that sort of logic is applied, you might be in a cult.
Mm-hmm. So with cults and coercion, we're talking a lot about human trafficking and modern slavery, mm-hmm. which really does come under the umbrella of cults. And people might not think that those two things are directly related. When you hear about somebody being trafficked and you hear about cults, you might think, how does Charles Manson or Jim Jones link to, you know, a child being sent to another country? But it's so much more than that, as a lot of you in this room probably know. And just to finish up, really, our session today, where is the Unification Church right now? And what would you say is most notable for us in this room to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, number one, I'm glad you mentioned the term human trafficking. This is a human trafficking organization at the end of the day. It meets all of those criteria, and they hide behind this hall of mirrors of all of these front groups so that nothing can ever be pinned on any one individual or one group.
You mentioned the mass weddings as well. The true agenda behind the mass weddings is not part of the doctrine, but actually to further the agenda of.
Yeah, and so actually, we kind of skipped over that earlier, but the Moonies became famous in the 70s and 80s for holding these mass weddings. They say it's for theological reasons, but my personal belief, after speaking to a lot of people about this, is it was actually massively premeditated way to circumvent labor laws by getting people to certain places. So that sushi business that I mentioned earlier in the U.S., all of the workers who did that, and actually in this country too, all of the workers in those places came from Japan, and the reason they could stay in Europe and the U.S. is because Moon married them to citizens of European countries as well as the U.S. And we're talking thousands of people here. That's mm-hmm. a good point. Mm-hmm. I know we're short on time. I think just to really like make it salient and relevant to what's happening right now. The Moonie org still hosts regular events where they'll have names like the Family Federation for World Peace or the Universal Peace Federation or the International Federation for World Peace, these sort of innocuous sounding names, and they will invite heavy hitters to speak at these, and they will pay them money to speak at them. When I say heavy hitters, I mean heavy hitters. Donald Trump spoke at one of these. Mike Pompeo, Mike Pence spoke at one of these. These people are taking money, human trafficked money. So first of all, they're profiting from human trafficking. And second of all, the Moonies are then using that to their constituents and saying, hey, look, Trump spoke at our event. He supports us, blah, 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 blah. So it's used to further the cycle of abuse. The last thing I want to say there, I know you're looking at your watch, it's not just politicians. Jose Manuel Barroso, the current chairman of Goldman Sachs, has taken money to speak at multiple Moonie events. He is guilty of accepting human trafficking money, and I think he should be held accountable. And there are a lot of other people as well. He's one of the most high profile. Thank you.
For more information on Elgin's amazing show, he covers all of this meticulously with obviously himself and other survivors on his show. Falling Out is available. Season 3 has just started to release wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Casey, host of The Cult Vault. You can come and chat to us. Please come and chat to us at our stall on Podcast Row. Thank you so much to Nancy and the team for having us here today. And I really hope that you enjoy your weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is the end of this bonus episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram @cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, host of the Cult Vault Podcast.